Did you ever ask yourself the question, can climate change and depression be connected? Are people who worry about the Earth's animals and plants more likely than others to experience stress and even depression related to climate change? And even though wildfires, extreme storms, and major weather events can seem like a distant threat to many of us, what about people whose lives have been directly impacted by these events and the threats hit much closer to home for them? Researchers at the University of Arizona asked those questions and found some answers. Stay with me to learn just what they found out. This is going to be a fascinating show. Welcome, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for listening and for being a part of our world. And a big shout out and thanks to the sponsor of this show, the Chapman Automotive Group. They are one of the top 150 car dealerships in the country, and they make a big difference when it comes to the environment. Their green team in Tucson, Arizona, have active partnerships with organizations like Goodwill, Habitat for Humanity, and Pima Animal Care Center. They don't just sell cars and they don't just write checks. They show up to make the communities in which they live and work more sustainable and socially just, and I love all of that about them. For more information, please visit ChapmanTucson.com, and you can find out a lot more about where Mrs. Green frequents when it comes to her car. So our show today is extremely relevant to me, and I'm sure to many of you who are paying attention to the devastating impacts of climate change on our planet and its inhabitants, including our oceans, our forests, our animals and birds, and millions of human beings who are being displaced or starving or living in conditions we don't even want to think about. So how is it impacting people's mental health? How are we coping as a society? As reports of such mental health incidents continue to rise, researchers at the University of Arizona set out to learn more about people's reactions and their perception of the threat of global climate change and how it affects their mental health. So joining me in studio for the next hour is Sabrina Helm. She is the Associate Professor at the University of Arizona, Associate Professor, University of Arizona Norton School of Family and Consumer Sciences. So Sabrina, that's a long title. Did I do it justice?
Absolutely wonderful.
It's you know, we got a little chance to chat before we went on air, and I explained to you why this show matters to me so much and why I'm so, not just emotionally, but intellectually excited about this, because you're right. We pay so much attention to what's happening to the earth and to our rivers and to our oceans and to our streams and maybe to the displacement of people, but this took a much deeper cut. And that's what got me excited. And I always want to know, for the first question out of the chute, how this got started, because it's significant research, if you ask me, and there's very little done that explores the psychological effects of climate change. So what made you and your researchers take this on?
Well, Gina, first of all, thank you so much for having me and for giving me the opportunity to talk about this a little bit more. And I'm excited that somebody's excited about my research.
You can tell our whole team is excited. It's like, yeah, it's people that it's impacting. And maybe this will wake more people up about we got to get going.
Yeah, so the way we got started, we were quite a team from actually my department, Family Studies and Consumer Sciences. And it was sort of like more accidental, because our college had this little research fund, and they did a competition, and we had to come up with topics that people, you know, we come from very different disciplinary backgrounds, so it was meant to, you know, spur interdisciplinary research, and we came up with this idea. Hey, wait a minute, yeah, I'm a more like a marketing scientist, or I'm a marketing specialist in my field.
So we have to talk about that later.
Oh, yeah, that's a whole different ballgame, right, exactly. But my colleagues from the family studies side, they are the experts in psychology. And so we got together, and I had this interest in, you know, sustainable consumption. And that led to an interest more in climate change, because I recently moved to Arizona and everything's obviously very dry and very different, and got very concerned about the environment. And so we came up with this idea, pretty much. We tried to find out, okay, how does this worry about climate change affect people mentally? And then we started looking at the literature, and there's just virtually, at the time, was nearly nothing out there. Very little had been done. And so we thought, oh, this is a good idea. And we got funding. We sort of won the little competition there from our college. And that's how we set out to conduct our first studies. And we did several ones. And the one that is reported here in a journal that you're referring to is a survey study that we conducted within this project.
And I'm always curious about a little bit more about, you know, a survey study. How do you go about picking the people and targeting to get... You didn't want a specific outcome. You wanted to do research. But how do you know who to ask and involve in the study?
Well, this is a study that was directed at pretty much everybody and anybody. So we didn't have any particular criteria for picking people. So we were just looking for people participating in this study that are, I wouldn't call them representative for the United States, for the population, but that approximate that. As I said, it's about mental health of anybody, any people. I from my perspective, like to call them consumers.
And we're all consumers.
And so we didn't have any particular criteria. So you could probably involve anybody in that kind of a study.
Did you have a sense for, like, was there so much of what's being talked about now with cultural biases? Was it a representative sampling of socioeconomic groups, of racial and ethnic groups? And that doesn't diminish any of the outcome. I'm just curious about that.
I think what we saw, we skewed a little bit higher in education than the population average, but other than that, and I think also a little bit higher in income, but that's about it. Other than that, it comes fairly close to U.S. population.
And I really want you to go into some detail about what you found, which was fascinating to me, that the psychological responses varied depending upon people's level of concern, and you actually were able to identify three levels of concern. So, of course, when I'm doing the research, I'm saying to myself, well, which one are you, Gina? Which one do you fit in? So can you tell us about what you and your colleagues found?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and I have to give credit to another research team, namely Wesley Schultz, who came up with the initial idea that there's different types of environmental concern that people can harbor. So we can be concerned about the environment due to different reasons. It may be, that's what we call the egoistically motivated people who worry about the state of the environment because their own circumstances change. Their property value may diminish. Their own health may be affected. So it's really more about themselves that they worry about. And then there's others whom we call the socially altruistically concerned people who they worry because people will be affected. Yeah, future generations will be affected, children will be affected, people in general. And then there's another group that we identify as the biospherically concerned people, and they worry about nature in general. What are the effects of climate change on animals, on plants, and then what we call nature, Mother Nature. And what's important, I think, to note is that people can harbor these different kinds of environmental concern in parallel. So it's not there's people who are
only...
You
don't fit in one box.
Not necessarily. Some people do.
I was trying to get myself in which box. I'm like, well, I do care what happens to me, and then I do care what happens to everybody on the planet, and I really do. And then the biospheric was interesting to me because that's a little bit cleaner, nature, plants, and animals.
Right. And I guess what's interesting about the research is we try to find out how much ecological stress do people perceive. So how worried are they, for instance, about the state of pollution of the oceans and deforestation? And then we also looked at how do they psychologically cope with this knowledge and this stress that they may perceive. And again, I have to give credit to other researchers here. There's a scale that's been developed, a measurement tool, which is on ecological coping. has been developed by a group of German researchers around Homburg and others. And so they identified 8 different kinds of coping with environmental concerns or environmental stress. From it's a broad variety. Some of those are more like, I would say maybe ineffective, but wishful thinking. Yeah. Oh, it's not going to be so bad.
Somebody's going to find all the answers out, and there's young people working on the solutions.
Technology is going to save
us,
right?
Not fast enough, right.
Yeah, so there's those kinds of coping strategies, and these are all psychological coping strategies. It's all happening in our heads. Whereas others, they need to get informed. They need to find out more about also what they can do, and they have a more proactive stance towards this. And so there's all these different kinds of ways in which we potentially cope with this kind of a mental stress. And that, again, then has an impact on our reactions in terms of depressive symptoms, is what we also analyzed, as well as pro-environmental behaviors. Is there a different inclination to actually do something yourself? And I mean, you probably covered this many times in your show, but there's so many different.
Really, not enough. So that's what and when I say this, it's so sincere on my part about going deeper in this subject is fascinating to me. So people that you're talking about would be inspired to act and be proactive in the solutions. And we just need a couple of more billions of those people to kind of stem the tide a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess what's interesting to see is, if you look at these different types of people in terms of their environmental concern, it's the people who worry most about nature, animals, plants, who have the strongest mental impacts that they need to cope with. We see a link to perceived ecological stress. They're stressed out, more stressed out than the others. And they're also the ones who cope. Yeah, who need to cope and employ different strategies to do so. But they are also the ones who react more with depression and pro-environmental behaviors. Whereas those who are, it sounds like I'm pitting them against each other, which is, as I just pointed out, not correct because everybody may have these
pieces
different elements in them.
Right, right.
But those who tend to be more egoistically motivated, they are not stressed out. Yeah, by the decline in the environment, and they don't exhibit coping mechanisms because, I mean, they don't have to because they're not stressed out.
Are they among the profile of people who say it's going to be fine and we're going to have a technological solution to all the problems, or didn't it go into that? I don't want to make any assumptions, not based on research.
Yeah. Given that there's really no link between, you know, this egoistical concern and the coping mechanisms, we can't even say that they do any of those.
Right.
There's just a very weak linkage there. Yeah, they don't react with stress. They don't react with coping mechanisms. They don't react with depression.
Yeah. So the only group that was clearly linked to depression was the biospheric group?
Mostly, yeah. And in part, those who are altruistically concerned, because those also showed coping mechanisms. Yeah, and the coping mechanisms then were linked to depressive symptoms.
Got it. I'm really concerned about, I'm curious about, I know you can't put people in boxes, but was there a way to find out about who cares? And I mean, like, I live in a world that is so consumed by what is happening to the planet. I'm in a class all by myself because this is what I do for a living. I mean, there are more people that are doing whatever, but I lose perspective. Mm. And I wonder why everyone isn't as concerned as I am, because once you know better, you do better. So who cares? Is that a really tough one and beyond the scope of the study? But you have other experience in research that you might be able to speak to that about.
Yeah, first off, you know, also those whom we labeled, and this is just a label, yeah, egoistically concerned, they also care because they are concerned, but for different reasons. Yeah. And so what we see in our research very often is there's very few people that we capture in our samples, surprisingly, because I hear they're still out there. But we capture very few who negate climate change.
Who didn't care? Okay.
Yeah. We have a control measure in our data asking people whether they think climate change is happening and also responsibility for climate change. And we did not see differences in that regard. So the egoistically concerned people also think climate change is happening.
Right.
And also see a human impact in that. It's just that the outcomes of climate change touch them in a different way.
And realistically, climate change does impact people differently. You know, marginalized communities, first hit, hardest hit, women and children, hardest hit, first hit, socioeconomic groups. And I use Florida as an example a lot of times. You know, Miami is significantly underwater a lot of the time. Well, if you have a big McMansion on the beach in Florida, you just move. Literally, I mean, most people in those situations, especially in Florida, where, you know, high net worth on the beach is quite common, they can move. So they might care about the environment and that the water's coming up, but what they're looking for is where can they build their next house. So it just makes sense to me that some people who are of means, even not the mega millionaires, in a case of a hurricane, if you have extended family and you're a certain income and you have relatives that live somewhere else, you can go live with them. So it makes sense that some people aren't as concerned, because it comes down to it not only they don't think it's going to happen to them, but it won't be as severe. Is that fair?
Yeah, and again, I wouldn't say that they're not concerned. They're concerned about different things.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they are concerned about the effects that it's going to have on their own health, maybe on their property value and things like that, but they are concerned.
Maybe the health of their spouse or their children or something else.
Yeah. So it's just that they worry more about what's happening to things and people in their immediate surroundings, which is why it's being labeled egoistically concerned. That doesn't mean they only care about themselves.
Right. Yeah? Right.
It's just that they regard climate change and its effects in a different manner than those who are, for instance, biospherically concerned, who worry about nature and what it's going to do to species.
And that is, you know, I keep going back to this. Like, you can imagine how many things come across my computer that are potential for shows and guests and things that I'm curious about and want to know more about. And Kelly finds things and people write to us wanting to be on the show. But that's part of what so intrigued me about this, that there are, I mean, I read it all and I'm like, this is fascinating. And probably a lot had to do with the way I live and show up in the world and what shuts me down and what doesn't. But that you really got down what I call, you know, my overused expression these days is you got down in the weeds and did the research to tell us what exactly is going on in people's minds. And it was a representative sampling. I mean, I love that. Were there a lot of parents? That is of interest to me,
they
too.
They actually were all parents.
They were all parents.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, because I mean, given that this research is housed, you know, within family studies, we had initially, our initial interest was actually to find out more about how families cope within the family structure about, you know, issues of climate change. What does that mean? You know, how do they interact with their children, for instance? How does that have an effect? And building on that for future research, yeah, what does that mean for how children grow up nowadays, yeah, with the knowledge of climate change? And
I think that's going to be your next study, if I can put the suggestion here.
For sure, for my colleagues, who
yeah,
are much better prepared to do that than me, actually.
But I thought about things like that when reading this, because it's just, you and I talked a little bit, you got here and we could chat a little bit about the show before the show and what it was like for me growing up, which was basically go home, do my homework, and then play outside. And pretty normal for most kids growing up my age. We were in a middle class family and my dad worked, my mom stayed home. I was not thinking about climate change. And kids these days have to. There's the YouTube is filled with kids voicing their concern about the planet and why they're doing things that they're doing. It's such a heavy burden for young children.
Yeah.
I mean, it's happening, which makes me think maybe it is on the news more than I think, but I'd like climate change to be a segment on the news every single night about what's happening now and what you can do about it. You know, we're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, you mentioned what the biospheric people do. I'd love to know what the altruistic and egoistic people do in terms of their actions. And then I'd like to talk about how do we use this? I'm not going to be a part of it other than sharing the word, which is really important, but how do we use it to help cope? And I know that you're not a psychologist, but there are things, if you saw, you know, like calls to action, and I have a couple of quotes, and I'd love to give a big shout out to some of the other people on your team, because that is one of my pet peeves, and Diana Liverman will be proud of me for that. Everybody, stay here with me. We're having a fascinating show with Sabrina Helm from the University of Arizona, Norton School of Family and Consumer Sciences. We'll be right back.
Please join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can also find us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and SpeakUp Radio. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about this podcast or others, please write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But now, back to our story.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks for joining us. And just allow me to do a brief, personal, heartfelt request from me and the entire Mrs. Green's World team. Help us fuel the movement for a healthier, more livable planet, one podcast, one video, one social media post at a time. Become a Mrs. Green's World member. You can become a member for as little as $2 a month, and all it takes is to visit our website at MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member, and we so hope you do. We have big dreams and big plans and more things we'd like to do, and as you all know, it takes fuel for this movement, and we would love you to help us fuel that. So check out MrsGreensWorld.com and become a member, and we will be eternally grateful, and so will Mother Earth. Climate change and depression, are they connected? What have some researchers found out when they asked that question? Joining me to talk about a research study is Sabrina Helm, Associate Professor, University of Arizona, Norton School of Family and Consumer Sciences. It's great to have you here, and as you can tell, my exuberance about the research. And it's, you know, it is, that's the egoistic part of me, seriously, because I have trouble coping some days, and mm-hmm. I told you that. There are days when I do a show that is so dark and so sad to me that my coping mechanism is to, you know, binge watch some dumb TV show, or, you know, The Crown, some maybe not so dumb TV show. But that is actually one of my coping mechanisms. I watch something that is not crap, I hope, on TV, to just block it out all out, because I have to figure out ways to, you know, put my protective wall around. And I'm sure after doing the study, you understand that, because my getting depressed and shutting down does not help serve the planet in any way, shape, or form. It just has to be a moment, and then get up, get on your feet, get up and make it happen. So let's talk a little bit about the altruistic and the biospheric. You know, you talked about the biospheric, but the egoistic and the altruistic. How does it change their behavior in the way they show up every day in the world?
Well, that I'm not sure I can actually answer, because in our data, they don't show up in that way, you know, because
the people. Just the biospheric?
Yeah, because though there's, you know, if you look at these models in that we extract from our data, we really only see that those biospherically concerned people react stressed out and have to cope with being stressed out. And that relates to depression, and it relates to pro-environmental behavior. For the others, we can't really say that, because for instance, the egoistically concerned people, they are not stressed out.
Yeah.
They're concerned, but they're not stressed out. So if you will, it's psychologically or mentally seen, or from a mental health perspective, it's great if you're egoistically concerned, because you're not stressed out. Right. Yeah, your psychological makeup is much sounder in this regard because you're not freaked out by climate change.
But doesn't it matter that even if you're not freaked out, you're changing behaviors?
I mean, it matters.
That's the key.
It matters in a social context, yes. For sure. But it does. I mean, that's the thing. In our study, we look at mental health effects on the individual. That's what we can measure in our data. We cannot say much about, you know, how does this individual then react in the biggest, you know, picture, just in terms of the data that we collected. And it makes sense that if you're not so worried about things, you...
Why do you have to change anything?
You don't have to
change anything. It's like, somebody's going to come up with that great big answer, which many client scientists have assured me that is not going to happen because some of the bigger names are like, no, if we stopped right now and fixed everything, we're still on a trajectory of having to do quite a bit of repair work to get to what would be considered a healthy planet. So it's we have a lot of CO2 stored up there.
Yeah, and I mean, you were talking about, you know, being so stressed out because you know so much. I mean, there's this link. Yeah? The more you know, the more likely you get to be stressed out. Ignorance is bliss,
yes,
of course, also mentally speaking. It's the same, you know, if you're researching these topics, it freaks you out. Yeah. Every day you're looking at the data. Every day you're dealing with the ignorance that's out there. And it's very hard to cope also on that level. And you see your study published and it's wonderful. And you see it's gaining traction. That's all wonderful. But you still think, does this make a difference? Because if it doesn't make a difference, it only freaks me out. But it doesn't really help on a bigger scope, which would be sad. And you were also talking about, you know, how you grew up and it sounded, you know, so peaceful and idyllic and other what are our children going to face. Well, when I grew up in Germany, we were all freaked out because of nuclear threat.
Yes.
And it was very similar. Yeah.
Yes.
So if you look at these extreme stressors that are there, the climate change is a bit different, but you have terrorism threat, you have terrible natural catastrophes, and things like nuclear threat. Yeah, and I remember growing up, when I was maybe 14, 15, 16, I didn't think I was going to be able to go to university because we were all going to be dead. I was certain a big war was going to start again. And so, I mean, children are resilient. They grow up with these kind of stress all the time. Climate change is different because we know it's going to happen.
Right, and it's happening.
There's no uncertainty.
Right,
it's happening.
It's happening.
And it's happening slowly, which makes it so difficult to actually see. Yeah, that's why it makes it easy to keep psychological distance to it. Oh, there's stuff happening on the atoll somewhere in the South Pacific.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's very sad, but it's so far away. It's easy to retain that attitude if things happen so far away.
Because it's over there.
Yeah, not realizing that it's actually happening right now, right here in Tucson, every day. Because it's getting so much drier, we have no more water coming from the heavens. but it's more subtle.
And nature knows already, and they're adapting. I was so surprised. I had breakfast with a woman from the Desert Museum last week, and we were talking about how beautiful the saguaros are in the Southwest this year.
For a reason.
And they are so, and that's what she said, Sabrina. She said, oh yeah, there's a reason for that. And I said, what's the reason? She said, because the drier the climate, the worse the drought, they overproduce their seeds for their survival. And I'm like, they're smarter than people because they got the message. That shocked me. Absolutely and positively shocked me to know that I said I've lived here 42 years and I've never seen such beauty in the desert. We've really been making a point of going around and going to Saguaro Monument and looking because it's beautiful, but it's you know, of course, somewhat sad to me. So I want to read a quote. It's a perfect segue from you in the study. Climate change is a persistent global stressor, but the consequences of it appear to be slowly evolving. They're fairly certain to happen. We know that now, but the impact on individuals seem to be growing really slowly and needs to be taken very seriously. I mean, is that one of the things that is a big takeaway from this study? that not enough people are really getting on the program. And I told you, it frustrates me. I have breathing issues when I go to like a Target and someone is using 9 plastic bags for 8 items. I'm like, wow. And that's just a symptom. I mean, that is, you know, plastic bags are not our only problem, as you well know. So is it, how is it that people live in this planet? And you, Sabrina, I'm not expecting you to answer this, but, and are not walking around aware of the global threat, the biggest challenge we have ever faced as a civilization?
Well, my very simple answer to that is that as human beings, our psychological makeup lends itself to look at the moment and present moment survival, but not so much these more subtle factors that are changing our environment, which may mean that 10 years from now we can't live here anymore. I don't think we are not really well made for that kind of a threat and to cope with it. Or on the other hand, we are actually made brilliantly for that, because hey, we can live and do our work and be productive and be happy, although the world may fall down on us any second, and we're able to do that, which is actually pretty grand.
It is. That's not a negative thing. I mean,
no,
it's just like I said,
it's necessary.
What good does it do if you're shut down? It's survival.
Yeah.
It's really survival. And there's that whole part of, it helped a little bit to me when we had 3 major hurricanes that were devastating, but who thinks about it now? Even I don't, unless I'm giving a presentation. It's like, oh yeah, Harvey, Irma, you know, how are things in Puerto Rico? Well, one of my best friends is from there, so I ask her on a regular basis, but that's part of what we do. We move on. And Americans, in all of their blessed generosity, do give generously and help with millions of dollars outpouring of all kinds of things. But then you move on because the tide isn't rising in my backyard. But the desert Southwest, I mean, I'm fascinated with so much of the work at the University of Arizona in cooperation with the City of Tucson Water Department and all of that. I mean, we are already being hit very hard. And things are going to be a big deal. So let's take a moment to give a shout out to your co-authors who worked with you on this. It's a big deal. And I love Diana Liverman and, you know, Catherine Wilkinson from Project Drawdown and Kathleen Cahoe. They want us to talk about the other women that were involved in this. And it was a group effort. And you get to be the spokesperson, but you gave 2 thumbs up and you said, yes, let's do that. So Melissa Barnett, Melissa Curran, Zellianne Craig and Amanda Pollitt, who is an alumna. So I thought that was great. So they all worked with you on it. And was it fun too?
It was great fun. And I learned so much. Oh, it's awesome.
It had to be fun and fascinating.
Yes, yes, particularly because, I mean, as I said, this is an interdisciplinary team of researchers. I have no idea of some of the work that my colleagues have been doing and vice versa. And I learned so much from them. And plus, they're fabulous to work with. This was great fun, actually. And it also, I mean, there's always some, you know, you make mistakes. Like we started out, we actually did bring quite a number of parents and their small children into the lab at U of A, and we exposed them, you know, to climate change news, which
right,
was terrible,
right,
just to see how they would react afterwards and all that. And meanwhile, those were the parents who were watching this, and we were, you know, surveying them, observing them. It was like a big deal, very complicated, and my colleagues worked on that part, and their little children were taken care elsewhere. And what we found out afterwards at this study was that parents were so stressed out by having to bring their kids to the lab.
And it's not a good
that we couldn't really measure anything.
But how fascinating to find that out. That's why they call it research.
Yeah, that really didn't work out. So we had some fun, but it was also a lot of work. And then we had to look for other measures and other ways to
right,
to
and
get
to bring them
data.
To talk about such a dark subject, which is, you know, it's a pretty heavy duty subject. So that's awesome. So this might seem like a strange question. You may not be able to answer it. I never put my guests on the spot and say, please answer this. But can you, were there some observations about how it impacted all of you and what you learned? And did you find yourself doing what I did? Like, which am I? Am I egoistic? Am I biospheric? Am I altruistic? Were there reflections or maybe even an increase in the level of consciousness about how bad things are? Or what were some of the personal reactions of such a looks like a wonderful, fun team? When I read, I thought, oh, this is a bunch of women that would really have a lot of fun too.
I think so. For me personally, I had done research in this field before. So I was the one, I guess, who was already most doomy and gloomy about climate change. Yeah. And unfortunately, I think that may have also, rubbed up on my colleagues in that process who now are probably more worried than they were before, which would be unfortunate. So I did observe that, and obviously also the discussions that we had, and also moving forward, because we were thinking a lot about, okay, how can we take this forward and try to find out more about how it affects families who apparently are not yet, you know, that much threatened by climate change, and their children, and how they interact with their children. And so I think we got to think about that a lot more. And meanwhile, I had a child in the course of, you know, all these studies, and now I find myself being a mother, being obviously doubly worried about all this.
Yes.
And I can no longer be the egoistically motivated.
That's right. It's
worry
kind of a luxury. No, it's so true. And, you know, my daughter, who is, you know, she's been married, she'll be married 3 years in October, very close to her, we talk about it, and she just says to me, Mom, do you think we should have kids, knowing what you know and all of this? So yes, so answer that. I of course told her yes, because I want to, there's the ego, I want to be a grandmother again. But what's the serious answer to that?
Yeah, this is really a big one. And I thought about this for a while, actually, and it's kind of funny because I really, my background has nothing to do with this, so I'm just, you know, a lay person in any regard here when I talk about this. But I had discussions with some of my colleagues who are also very much into, you know, research in ecology and all that. And one of my colleagues, she said, well, I'm going to have another child and I feel bad about it. Yeah, because the worst thing you can do in terms of your carbon footprint is have a child.
Yes. Yes. And population.
Population and consumption and all that goes on with, and then you get into this whole thing with, okay, all the diapers you need, all the, I mean, it's just terrible. And that totally struck me. I'm like, this is so sad. And I never thought I was going to have a child, so I never really worried about it from that perspective. About how do you feel as a mother when you question, should I have a child or not? Which is so against our natural makeup.
It is. It's against the procreation of the species. It's like the,
and it's a war of the mind against the spirit, the soul, the body. Yeah, and so it's very difficult. And so we are also thinking about that. You know, is that a relevant study to conduct? See how does the threat of climate change affect people's wish to have children? Yeah, but we already thought about this, but we feel like, you know, we all live in our own little echo chamber. So now I'm sitting here with you in a true echo chamber. Are the only people really worried about these kind of issues that take it that far that they would really consider or reconsider having children, just the few of us? Or is this really a bigger picture issue that there's many more people actually affected by this? And they may not be worried about the climate and being, you know, green every day in every action that they're doing, but they are still concerned about the future that their children might be facing, and maybe that has an impact, at least mentally. And you don't want moms or to be moms to be worried about these kind of things. It's just terrible. You have enough other things you need to worry about. So to have to think about, okay, what kind of a future is my child going to have, is absolutely terrifying.
It is. It really is. It was so sad when I was asked that as a mother and Mrs. Green, you know, to my daughter, and saying, what a responsibility in my answer, mm-hmm. because she does care what I think. And I just, you know, I said, of course I want you to have children, and I think that we will be proactive in helping to be the change. But I wasn't going to say, no, don't have a child. I just, it was not in my DNA. And it's there is a part of me that doesn't see the technological silver bullet coming, but that does see an increase in the consciousness that will help maybe.
And that's, I think, a very important point. First off, the children now grow up differently, and it's my true hope, if not conviction, that they have enough education, if not in this state or country, then elsewhere, to really make change. It's a different generation. I see that among my students already, who are much older than my child, but they already will make a change. So there will be that. And I have my own personal coping mechanism as a mama, as a mother of now one. He's going to be a climate scientist. He's going to be the one who's going to bring the big change.
Yes,
that's why we have him now.
Yes. I mean, that's
my personal coping mechanism.
Those are the kind of things that you see. And I just, one little thing, I get manically or maniacally obsessed about straws because I think it's a gateway to consciousness. So if we're using 500 million straws a day in the United States, and the news for me, I'm like, oh, look, Alaska Airlines is banning straws. MGM, all of their hotels, they're banning straws. The city of Seattle, banning straws. So I start to see these and I say, that is a gateway to consciousness. People are realizing that. It will help. It is not going to preserve the planet. But if we get down to 250 million a day, that helps oil production, transportation, CO2 emissions, water use. So there are little things of hope. And I do what you do. It's like, oh, yeah, see, people are getting it. They're starting to realize that something's happening. So we have to take another short break. And I have some really good questions for you when we come back about outcomes and how has the work been received by the scientific community in general? There's a couple of things I'd love to know about that end of it. So everybody, stay here with me. If you're like me, you're not going to want to miss a word of this.
Hi, it's Meredith, a proud member of the Mrs. Green's World team. We are disruptors for good, passionate game changers working to create a more sustainable, safer, healthier, and socially just planet for all. By creating podcasts like this one, we offer tangible solutions that inspire you to take action. We need your financial support to continue producing content, podcasts, film, and written works that engage, educate, and inspire our global community to fight climate change. Join us today. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click Join the Movement.
And welcome back, everybody, and thanks for listening and being a part of this very interesting and really important conversation. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And before we get on to the topic of the show, I want to do a shout-out to my team, which, why don't I do it more? I've been listening to a lot of podcasts lately, and we've got Kelly and Meredith and Katie and Bonnie and Dave and James and Lynn who make the wheels on this bus go round and round. They all have their roles, and they're all part of what we believe to be a very important mission, and I want to give a thanks to them, and I hope I remember to do it more. I heard this podcaster the other day, and he said, and I want to thank the people who helped make this possible. So I'm moving away from the egoistic and moving more into the other direction, but I thank them enough when I'm not on the air. So climate change and depression, are they connected? Helping us shed some light on that very important question is Sabrina Helm, Associate Professor, University of Arizona, Norton School of Family and Consumer Science. Sabrina, it is great having you here, and I'm sure you can tell. So I have another quote that I love that you did. It says, climate change has evident physical and mental health effects if you look at certain outcomes, such as the hurricanes we had last year, but we also need to pay very close attention to the mental health of people in everyday life, as we can see this potentially as a creeping development. Understanding that there are differences in how people are motivated is very important for finding ways to address this, whether in the form of intervention or prevention. That was one of the quotes that stood out. It screamed, we have to pay attention to this for ourselves, whatever level of consciousness we're at, for our children, for our grandchildren. So what are some of you, I mean, you're not a psychologist, but what are some of those things that we need to be, kind of cued into, even as the scientific community and for scientists to be talking about this more? What are some of the potential positive outcomes that you hope will come about as you have really raised the consciousness? Obviously, you got me. I'm in the fan club. It's like, and it's not something I say lightly. It's a big deal.
Well, I think one of the very important things is a lot of the debate about climate change naturally is in doom and gloom and all very sad and bad and frightening. But with these kinds of sentiments, it is very hard to motivate people to do anything, because our defense mechanism is that we shut down if we hear something that's so unpleasant and so frightening. So we try to shove that away from us. And that's how we can cope with these things that are so, and I said that earlier, psychologically distant. If it's not like a bomb drops on us right here in our house, right now, and I got to run away. It's creeping development. It's harder to see. Yet it's very, very frightening. And we hear, the world might be coming to an end and all that. So how are we actually supposed to live if that's the kind of messaging that we get? So why it's very hard to frame climate change in a positive light. I'm at a loss of trying to do that. But
I mean, it really is.
But there's messages, that need to be revolved about action, as you do every day.
Right.
It's not like it is already too late and nothing will stop this. It is possible to do something if everybody does something. The inconvenient part of it is, of course, also that a lot of it needs to be governmental action.
Yeah. Policy. And when you're talking about the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, if we destroy that, it's unconscionable to me about what a piece of our world will be gone forever. It's Humpty Dumpty. It's not getting put back together. So policy is important. So one of the coping mechanisms that I have is when I get really down, which isn't a lot. I mean, sometimes it feels heavy, but I flip it and say, okay, so what can I do to feel better? So to me, I give this talk about kindness, connection, and compassion. And the crux of it, of my message, is all of us have to really figure out a way to consciously connect with nature more. We are so disconnected. Kids are disconnected. They think their food comes from the supermarket. And they think their milk comes from the supermarket, not from cows who, whatever. So that's one. And then is the other part of it, I sign a lot of petitions. And they are working, like change.org and Act Blue. They are getting attention. When you get a million signatures in 3 days, we made some connection, impact on the pipeline. You know what I mean? So are there things like that that people can do? And I know that wasn't a part of your study, but you are a consciously living being. Those are, people need tools. Like, yeah, that's all great. I don't want to feel like Debbie Downer. What can I do to be the change?
Well, I think it's very important to realize as a citizen and as a consumer, we have a multitude of ways how we can impact what's going on in terms of the environment. And it's important to understand that even if we are just one, we have a lot of power because of social media, because of our consumption patterns, because of what we can do in a democracy in terms of voting. So there's a multitude of ways. We see that looking at how consumers, for instance, deal with their own role with regard to the effect that they can potentially have on the environment. There's people who are, there's a whole range, and we call that perceived consumer effectiveness.
Okay.
Do I, as one consumer, think that what I do really matters? And it's easy to say no, right?
Yes.
It's just one straw.
It is definitely the easiest way.
It's just one straw.
What difference can I make?
And so, so that's disastrous. Yeah, if that's the perspective that people take. So it's very important to show and to see that even these little things do truly matter. On the other hand, there's a slight danger in that from the standpoint of policymakers, if I'm, looking at a community of people who all are very involved in green behaviors, nothing else needs to be done. But actually the big picture issues need to be addressed by policy. Not just, I need to take the straw and I need to refuse to get a straw. And similar actions that I can do as a consumer every day, nonstop, just by thinking about what I'm doing. And in the blog, it was mindfulness. Yeah, be more mindful about what your actual activity results in. But the big picture issues need policy level involvement, and that's where the role of voters comes in.
And energy policy. That's, you know, I mentioned to you, I'm friends with Nancy Peterson, and we got into this great debate about, you know, she said, Gina, really, straws don't matter, and this doesn't matter, and doesn't matter. And she wasn't saying that they don't matter. She's saying we have to focus on healthier buildings and, you know, our CO2 emissions and transportation and infrastructure. And I agree with her, but I think the journey of a lifetime begins with a single step, and some people have to start with something that they can cope with on this day.
Yeah, and I think just being able to change your behavior to get one thing right or different,
yes,
then helps you also reconsidering your other activities. And even if as one individual you may not have the greatest impact, you have an impact on others around you. You have an impact on your family. And with that, it's growing and it gets more substantial. If you then take this activity on the level of citizenry and take it into your voting activities, well, then fairly soon you're doing as much as you can as a consumer, unless you want to become an activist.
And if you look around at some of the epic changes, for example, Walmart carrying organic milk, that happened because mothers united. Mothers said, I don't want to feed this hormone-filled milk to my child so that she starts, you know, getting her period at 8 years old. I want organic milk. And the consumers demanded it. And there have been some boycotts, like against Hershey for chocolate, where it did spread. So the consumer part of it, people got upset, they got informed, they took action, and changes came about as a result of it. So I don't think we can ever give up hope. Some days, you know, a petition will come in and I'm like, oh, man, I signed so many petitions, what good does it do? And then I think of the times when it really did some good, because lawmakers, they used to anyway, care about how many people in their districts were signing things like that. So I think it's really important. And, you know, I just wanted to comment too, and I don't know if you've observed this, but one of my friends is a pediatric neurologist, and climate change is having a profound impact on her because she sees sick children. And she has shared with me that they're sicker, worse, younger. She said, when you see two-year-olds with migraines and how many toxins are in the umbilical cord, how many toxins they're picking up from the environment, there's just what I call this ripple effect that's not being measured of people in caring professions that are seeing obesity, diabetes. I mean, it impacts all of us, and we might not be relating it to climate change, but we should be.
When the study came out, and University of Arizona, you know, and their media service spread the word, and
I thank them for that.
We got interesting, you know, feedback, and this is actually the first time that any of my research has received so much,
it's so
different opinions and some. It was very interesting as an experience, you know, because whenever you write anything about climate change as a scientist, you get the whole spectrum of responses to that. So it's interesting. But one of them was a teacher from, I believe, California, who sent me an email and wrote that throughout most of his career, he has tried to get children to be more environmentally conscious, and he has really integrated the environment and environmental issues into his curriculum, and it has burned him out. And that when he read about the study that there's actually potential mental health effect, he felt like, yes, absolutely, that's me. And my coping mechanism is I totally had to give up. He actually had to go into a retreat and you know, block all this stress out for a long time. And his decision had to be to no longer teach about the environment and climate change, because it was just too much.
That's profound. Probably he was a great teacher.
Yeah.
Lord knows we need more great teachers. And I mean, there are so many out there, but that's the kind of thing where I was thinking about it for the show. There are these ripple effects that we're not even looking at or measuring of people that have to deal with it. Did I give you time to answer your question about how important it is for people to reconnect with nature?
That's what we see in other studies, not the ones that we conducted, but very clearly nature connectedness has a strong impact on, of course, mental health, about decisions people make in terms of environmental behaviors as well. Yeah, very, very clearly. And I also am a strong believer that we can't get the kids out there early enough. and let them interact with nature and understand that there's this whole universe that is much more beautiful than anything that they can find indoors, and that they need to have a concept of that. Food is so important, understanding where food comes from, what food does, the role of food in people's lives, how it makes you feel, yeah, and why it does so, where it comes from, what effects it has if we all eat beef, if we all eat the hamburgers. It's a profound effect. And again, our decisions matter even in that regard. I cannot believe that there's, you know, 3-4-year-olds who don't know what an avocado looks like.
I know, or, especially if they live here.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating because you think, again, you're in your own echo chamber. I look around, I look at my friends, I'm like, of course, they buy organic food, they feed their children organic food and all that. But that's just not everybody. And
not everybody is. I think we have to start a hashtag, Sabrina, hashtag echo chamber, because you nailed it when you said that. I mean, I call it the bubble.
Yeah.
Because I do hang around with people that are like-minded, that are saying to me, like, entertaining, you'll be so proud of me, Gina. I don't have any styrofoam, no paper plates, no water bottles. And you know what? I am proud of them. Because if 100,000 people decide to do that, it really matters. But echo chamber, the ECO chamber, oh my gosh, that's one that's going to stick with me because I think I live in that. Before we have to say goodbye, which it will come up before you know it, do you have, you mentioned this teacher wrote to you and there's been an impact. Has there been much feedback from the climate science community at all to your work? Because I hope the answer is yes, but I'd love to know what is the truth. I can handle the truth.
I don't know, because maybe they read the paper but didn't, you know, write anything, which usually, we read each other's stuff and we're like, oh, this is very interesting and I'm going to write something similar, so I'm going to cite this, yeah? So that hopefully...
that's the mind of a researcher. Okay.
Yeah, that's the merit that we get, yeah? So that's all. But in general, you know, I'm also affiliated with the Institute of the Environment here at the University of Arizona. A lot of the climate change related research doesn't deal with people.
Right.
Yeah. And it may sometimes deal with people in terms of messaging and communication of climate change. And so there's a whole stream in journalism and communications that's done a profound and great job. But there's not that much out there that really looks at, you know, everybody's kind of mental reactions, yeah, in terms of psychology. So the American Psychological Association has done work in that regard, but it's just not enough to really make much of an impact yet. And so I would very much hope that there's going to be more of an interest in understanding, you know, the psychological effects that climate change has on us, on the children.
And I can't help but conclude, in my unscientific background, that it will help. Because when you connect it to people and the impact on them, instead of just talking about that out there and the disconnect, if you understand what it might be doing to your health right now, you pay more attention. Because the number one reason why people make decisions is their health. The egoists and everybody else is like, how is it going to affect my own health? So more conversation about this and how it can impact your mental health. And you might not even know that that's what it's, that that's why. And the air you're breathing and the toxins that you're bringing in your home, talking about the impact on people, not just displaced people in, you know, India or what's going on in Bangladesh or all those centers of hell, as I call them, where we can't even get our heads around it. You know, Myanmar, don't do that. Go ahead.
There's also another issue related to this, because there's a certain stigmatization of people who are very green, right?
Right, right.
Particularly in this country. And so initially when we started working out the different variables that we have in our model, we used to call the eco-stress, eco-anxiety, you know, and that people have eco-anxious reactions and all that. And then we learned that that's actually a sort of like defamatory term that's being used, you know, to highlight people who are these super green, nervous individuals because they cannot find a recycling bin and they throw a fit because they can't
hold
it, which is entirely ridiculous. Yeah. There may be some of these, but they're probably not the majority we want to talk about. But there's also, this is important to understand that there are extreme effects And there are the subtle everyday effects that climate change has on all of us all the time. And there's nobody in this society who will not be affected or is not affected, whether they realize it or not, in terms of their health and also their mental well-being.
That is the perfect last word. And I mean that. To talk about wrapping it all up, there is no escaping it. And that's the end of the message. This is just, this show flew for me. And I'm excited about your work. I want to make sure that we do everything we can to get it out there. And I want to invite people. Our next Down to Earth show is with Tim Sibley. Air filters, why they matter to your health. Upper respiratory disease, third highest cause of death in Pima County. It matters. And on June 26th, we're going into a whole new arena with Ruben Miller from Diversified Financial Advisors. They managed $900 billion in assets. And I'm going to be asking him about sustainable investing. Is it possible? So thank you, Sabrina. Thanks for the research you did. Thanks for all the work you did and for showing up here. It was just been a delightful show, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
I very much did, and thanks so much for having me.
It was delightful. And I can always make this plug at the end. If you want any information about this study, you can contact Mrs. Green's World. We have links to the study and an article about Sabrina and her team. So make it a great green, intentionally lived day, and don't turn into an eco nut because it doesn't help.